Do it with fighters alone.
We can hack that, Lefroy said, but only if we take their SBMs and capital missiles out of the picture. They only have 9 archers. Can the fighters get in and kill them first?
Commodore, Thera asked quietly, and Diego Jackson bared his teeth.
We can do it, he said confidently. It'll cost us, but we can do it.
In that case, Great Claw, I think we can do it, Lefroy said. They don't mount CMs in anything else, and we've got 9 capital missile battlecruisers. We send the fighters in to kill the archers, then empty the battlecruisers' magazines into them from outside their range. Instead of outright kills, we concentrate on knocking down their data link. Then the battle line pounds them with standard missiles from outside effective energy range and closes with the fighters in tight, like Admiral Murakuma did in Leonidas, and kicks their guts out from the inside.
Thera, Zarnak asked.
It should work, Great Claw, the Least Claw said. Yet casualties will be very heavy, and for us to attempt it, we must first complete our strike group's reorganization. That will require us to allow them to reclaim the warp point. So if it does not work, none of our ships will escape.
Lord Kiniak will reach Alawan in 6 days, Zarnak murmured as if to himself. Even if we are destroyed, his strength will hold the system, and if we do sufficient damage to the enemy, he will retake Telmaza with ease.
His eyes flicked to the icon of the Hairnow warp point, and his ears flattened. He gazed at it for several seconds, then inhaled sharply.
Very well, Commander Lefroy, you have convinced me. We shall send our worst damaged ships back to Alwan and attempt your plan with the remainder. And if we fail,
he raised one clawed hand, palm uppermost, and closed it slowly into a fist.
Then we shall end like Farshotok.
He smiled thinly.
It is a good day for it, war brothers.
Chapter 29 The Tips of Our Claws 10th Great Fang of the Khan Koraza Kiniak, Kanhaku Kiniak, CO 3rd Fleet, stood behind the side party in Khan's Mbimiai's boat bay and watched the cutter dock. It was a human cutter, and Lord Kiniak found that entirely fitting as he glanced about the cavernous boat bay at the officers and ratings of his new flagship. He had shifted his lights to Ebimiai only 6 days before, on his arrival in Telmaza, for she was the sole Orion battleship to survive second Telmaza. She deserved her status, and he felt a pride in her which only the Zirlikuvalkanai could fully have understood.
Or perhaps not, he told himself, thinking of the officer he was about to greet.
The hatch opened, and the pipes skirled. They did not offer the Khan's normal honors. Instead, they played Sons of Splendor, the anthem of the Terran Federation. 2 officers walked forward into that music. One was a tall, russet-furred Orion, the other a shorter, battered-looking human who leaned heavily on a cane. His uniform bore the brand-new insignia of a TFN vice admiral, but one side of his shaven head showed a freshly healed, cruel-looking scar, and his immobilized left arm hung useless. He moved slowly, in obvious pain, and the Orion at his side tried not to hover attentively over him.
"Task Force 37 arriving," the intercom announced.
That, too, was not usual Orion protocol, and Lord Kiniak saw surprise and pleasure in the human officer's face. The newcomers halted, and the human looked down at his cane, then gave a crooked human smile and braced painfully erect. He handed the cane to his companion, who took it gingerly, and saluted the son of the Khan at the side party's head.
"Permission to come aboard, sir," he said in the tongue of tongues, and the son of the Khan's salute would have done the Khan himself proud.
"Permission granted, Fang Prescott," he replied loudly, and Lord Kiniak stepped forward as Zarnak returned Prescott's cane.
Lord Kinyak carefully did not note the human's relief, or his small sound of pain, as he reclaimed his prop. But the Great Fang neither saluted Prescott nor offered his hand in the human greeting his guest could not return while leaning upon it. Instead, he gave a much deeper Orion bow than usual.
"I am most pleased to meet you, Fang Prescott," he said, "and to greet you once more, Great Claw."
This time he did extend a hand, and Zarnak took it. They brought their free hands flashing to one another's faces in a warrior's salute, and Lord Kinyak smiled.
"You bring great honor to us all, both of you. In the name of all the Sirukuvalkanai and of my Khan, I thank you."
Raymond Prescott watched Zarnak from the corner of one eye. The tabby actually looked embarrassed, and Prescott waited for him to speak. But the cat seemed to have Zarnak's tongue. Despite the pain of his wounds, the cliché made Prescott smile, and so he cleared his own throat. "Honor comes to those who act with honor, Great Fang," he said for them both. "And it was Afa Shatok who brought honor to us all."
"Well said, Fang Prescott,"
Lord Kinyak approved, then looked up. He clicked his claws, and a gorgeously bejeweled least claw stepped forward with a small, gem-crusted casket. Lord Kinyak took it in his own hands, and for all the solid weight of its precious metals and jewels, it seemed far too light for what it held as he turned back to his guests.
"Fang Prescott!"
No Orion would ever again greet this human by his TFN rank.
"Great Claw Zarnak! I bring you these as token of the honor you have earned. I speak in this as Hirikolus Nihami, with the mouth of my Khan, and my hand is his hand."
Prescott and Zarnak stiffened and squared their shoulders almost in unison. Technically, every member of the Orion military was Hirokolus Nihami, oath sworn to the Kanakanai, but Lord Kinyak's formal emphasis carried another, deeper meaning. It was the ancient meaning, that of a liege man and war captain who, in this moment, literally was the Khan, a physical avatar for his distant warlord, and hence for every Orion who had ever been or would be born. He opened the casket reverently, and Prescott heard air hiss between Zarnak's fangs as Lord Kinyak lifted out a ribbon of deepest midnight blue, the imperial color of the Khanate. A magnificent golden starburst hung from it, broad as a Terran coffee cup, yet delicate, exquisitely wrought like living, dancing flame, and a huge blood-red ruby glittered at its heart. The Great Fang returned the casket to his aide, who held it on open palms while his superior turned once more to face the Terran.
"Fang Prescott, in the name and stead of my Khan, I beg you to accept this in the name of all the human warriors who so valiantly perished defending the Sirukuvalkanai."
Kinyak paused, then allowed a very small flicker of amusement to flaw his solemnity, as he added softly,
"We have consulted with your navy and government, though we ask them not to inform you of our request and spoil our surprise, and they have approved."
Prescott paused to clear his throat. "I would be honored, Great Fang."
"Good."
Lord Kinyak settled the ribbon about his neck, then slapped him gently on the cheek with his claws.
"In all our history, only two warriors not of our own race have received the Ithiridoi Kanaku, and both were of Gormishvar Shotok. Your name will be added to the Khan's own clan fathers in honor, and you are no longer human alone, Raymond Prescott. By the blood you have shed and the lives you have saved, you are Sirukuvalkanai as well, Kanaku Prescott. And while our people endure, we shall not forget."
Prescott bowed deeply, but he said nothing. He wasn't sure he could have trusted his voice if he'd tried to, nor was it the Orion way to indulge in flowery speeches. Few words, but heartfelt ones, were the Orion ideal. The more profound the occasion, the less they spoke of it, and he felt Zarnok quivering with emotion beside him. Lord Kinyak gazed at him for a moment. Then his hand dipped into the casket once more for a smaller, equally beautiful copy of the star about Prescott's neck. This one was sized to fit an Orion officer's harness, and the Great Fang turned to Zarnok.
"As Fang Prescott, so you, Great Claw," he said quietly. "You are named no longer Zarnok Diano in the records of our clans, but Zarnok Telmaza, first father of Clan Telmaza, and our Khan has personally charged me to welcome you to his fathers in honor."
Zarnok gripped his Defargo's hilt so hard the tips of his claws emerged as Lord Kinyak removed the golden starship which marked him as an officer of the Khan and snapped the star into its place. He would never again wear that starship, for the Ithira Doikanaku would serve in its place, just as it would forever answer any slur upon his honor for retreating from Cleon. Lord Kinyak finished affixing the medal, then stood back with a bow.
"And now, war brothers, join me in my flag briefing room. I would hear our situation from your own mouths."
"And so we did," Zarnok finished quietly. "Commander Lafroy was correct. We did have the firepower, and as Thera had warned, the cost was heavy."
Lord Kinyak flicked his ears in slow agreement, pondering the vagaries of fate. His tardy order to stand fast had reached Alawan 7 hours after TF-37 launched its attack. Had he sent it when Governor Karsan first instructed him to, the task force would neither have attacked nor suffered such casualties, and Third Fleet would have paid an even more terrible cost when it discovered the enemy's AFOCs. He glanced into the repeater plot at the icons which had been added to his own order of battle. They were agonizingly few, for 90% of Zarnak's and Prescott's fighters had died in Second Telmaza, and their battle line had been savagely battered. The super-dreadnought Dathum had perished, along with the battleships Ambrich, Fikar, Colossus, Mexicano, and Umagos. Virtually every surviving capital ship was little more than a wreck. Prescott's Horned Viper had barely survived, and her flag bridge had been reduced to an abattoir. TG-37.2's battle cruisers had been almost as heavily hammered, and the entire task force had been reduced to impotence. But in return, TF-37 had destroyed every bug starship in Telmaza before the enemy discovered the warp point to Hernau. 1.5 billion civilians had been saved, and his own command faced only a single warp point assault to reach Cleon once more.
"You should not have done it, war brothers," he said softly at last. "You should not have, knowing I was coming. Yet it is well you did. Very well indeed. Thank you."
"We could not have done it without our human Farshatok," Zarnok said,
and Lord Kinyak nodded, hiding his amusement at hearing such words from an old-line fire-eater such as he who had been Zarnok Diano. He could hardly wait for Zarnok Telmaza's next interview with Kanhaku Diano. Clan lord or no, the old man would find cold welcome from Zarnok if he started on one of his anti-human harangues now.
"Truth, Great Claw," the Great Fang said, and turned to the human. "I am glad your own navy has rewarded you with promotion, Fang Prescott, and deeply regret that your fresh wounds will prevent you from serving with us when we return to Cleon. I trust they are less severe than original reports indicated."
"The leg will be fine in time," Prescott replied. "As for the arm," he gave a human shrug, "the surgeons have not yet given up hope, but I fear they have little to work with, and it may be as well if I leave Horned Viper. I seem to attract too much fire for her good." Lord Kinyak gave a purring chuckle at his wry tone. It was amazing how well this human spoke the tongue of tongues. Given Zarnak's original prejudices, the gods had smiled upon the Zirluku Valkanai indeed when they sent this man to them.
"We shall hope she suffers less in Cleon," he replied. "But I shall be honored to have her with us, and from all I have heard, Admiral Jackson will lead your Farshatok well."
"Diego is a good man," Prescott agreed, "and he certainly deserves promotion."
"Yes, well," the Great Fang stood.
"I thank you both for the briefing. Now I have other duties to attend to before we dine. Please remain here as long as you wish. Should you have any needs, my aide will remain on Flagbridge and will be happy to attend to them."
He waved them both back into their chairs as Prescott struggled to rise, then left with a graceful bow. Zarnak rose and crossed to the holo display, gazing at the ships which spangled it. 120 starships, led by 18 Gorm super-dreadnoughts and 11 Terran and Orion battleships, glowed in its depths, supported by 8 fleet carriers and 13 CVLs. Over 700 fighters rode those icons, fighters which now knew the enemy had Avhawks and would not be surprised again. And that knowledge, he knew, was almost as important to the Grand Alliance as to the relief of Hernau. It was a mighty force beside the one he and Prescott had led into Telmaza, and still more warships were en route. The Idnok sector had been saved, and as he stared at the lights, he felt the human who had truly made that possible behind him.
"We did it, War Brother," he murmured. "We truly did, and I never thought we could."
"Indeed," Prescott's chuckle turned Zarnak from the display, ears cocked, and the human laughed. "You hid your doubt well, Great Claw. Did I hide mine equally well?"
"Well enough I never saw it," Zarnak replied. "But the price, my friend, gods, the price was high."
"By the tips of our claws," the human agreed more somberly. He pushed himself up and limped over to the hollow on his cane. "We did it by the tips of our claws," he repeated softly.
"Truth."
Zarnak turned his head, studying Prescott while the human looked into the display, then cleared his throat.
"There is something I would ask of you, Fang Prescott."
"Huh?" The human's round-pupiled eyes looked at him from their flat, alien face, and Zarnak flicked his ears in agreement.
"We have seen much, you and I, and in the seeing I have learned even more about your people and about myself. I have not enjoyed my lessons, yet learn them I have, and it is my honor to have learned from one such as you."
The human's face darkened with the blush Zarnak had learned indicated embarrassment, but he went on quietly.
"Many years ago, I met Lord Talfon at a conference, and to my shame, I regarded him with contempt, for he had sworn Vilkshada with a human. Yet I know now why he did so, and so I ask this of you, little though I deserve it after so many years of foolish hatred."
He drew a deep breath.
"War Brother, will you swear Vilkshada with me?"
Chapter 30 Blind in the Dark.
"I have grown to hate my work."
Son of the Khan Shaira Halaira looked up as Small Claw Mariah Shirino spoke. Survey Flotilla 80's commander was tipped back in his chair while he nursed a beaker of Chermak. He flattened his ears in an expression of abject misery the most skilled actor could not have bettered, and Shairal purred a soft chuckle. The Orion term Mavarak was not one of approval when it was borrowed from humanity in ISW-3. That remained true for the majority of the Khan's officers even now, but it certainly fit Mariah. Yet, maverick or no, he was also one of the best survey officers the Khan had ever produced, which explained his rank at such a young age. Well, that and his status as the great-great-grand-cub of one Varnik Shirino, the greatest first fang in Orion history. Personally, Shiral suspected Maraya had deliberately developed his iconoclastic persona because of his lineage, for it could not be easy to bear such a name. Besides, Varnik himself had been a Mavarak in his day, even if the tongue of tongues had not then boasted the word. But whatever the small claw's motives, Shiral recognized a cue when he heard one.
"And why is that, small claw?" he asked respectfully.
"Because it is so boring," Mariah said plaintively.
Other ears cocked on Harkon's bridge as Shiral's officers and the small claw's staff listened. The Khan's survey crews were a tight-knit fraternity in which officers such as Mariah inspired a sense of camaraderie rare outside the strike-fighter community.
"We go through the warp point, we look around, we hunt for fresh warp points, and if we find one, we go through it and start all over again. Think of it, Shiral. If we had but reactor mass enough, we could sail forever without ever reaching the end of it all."
The small claw quaffed Chermak and shook his head mournfully.
"There is too much emptiness in the universe, and I have already seen half of it."
"Perhaps so," Shiral made his voice as sympathetic as he could.
"But you should not think of it in that way, sir. Instead, think of all the emptiness you may be yet the first to see." "Oh, thank you, son of the Khan. You have a gift, indisputably a gift, for encouraging your commander."
"Thank you, sir," Shiral replied, as a chorus of chuckles ran around Harkon's bridge.
"You are welcome."
The small claw let his command chair swing upright and set his chairmark aside. Satisfied, the byplay had taken some of the tension out of Shiral's bridge watch. Not all of it. A little tension kept people on their toes, but enough that he could now put it aside and get down to business. And, he thought, it could be very serious business indeed.
"Are we prepared, son of the Khan?" he asked the flag captain.
"We are, sir. The escort and fortresses are all at action stations."
"In that case, proceed to that fresh emptiness you promised me."
Shiral began giving orders, and Mariah left him to it. His own eyes strayed to the master plot, and he felt his claws try to ease from their sheaths. Survey Flotilla 80's 18 cruisers were almost lost amid the multi-hued lights of their escorts, and like every other person aboard Harkon, Mariah devoutly wished those icons were somewhere far, far away. But they were not. 4 months. No, 3 standard months, he reminded himself, for the Grand Alliance had decided to use human date conventions, had passed since Lord Kiniak's reconquest of Cleon demonstrated the consequences of the botched Shanak survey. 4 billion dead, an entire star system's habitable planets reduced to so much useless, irradiated wasteland. It was a lesson the Alliance would not forget. And what had begun as a war of honor to succor an ally had become something else for the Orion Navy, which had no equivalent of the human concept of turning the other cheek. The fury the Cleon atrocity had waked was impossible to exaggerate, and the consequences for the race which had wreaked it would be unimaginable. But Cleon had also shaken the Alliance to its core. The millions who had perished in the Romulus Cluster had been bad enough. The death toll in Cleon was obscene, and a wave of panic had washed outward from it. If it could happen to Cleon, it could happen anywhere. It could not, of course. Mariah knew that, but few civilians truly grasped the realities spacers took for granted. All they knew was that the planets of Cleon would lie lifeless for thousands of years. Mariah understood their fear, but he hated how the war had slowed as government strove to calm the panic. Every nook and cranny was to be fortified. Minefields were to be sown about every warp point, however far from the front, and massive covering forces were to be organized at nodal positions. It all amounted to an enormous diversion of industrial effort and priceless warships from offensive duties. and the impact on future operations would be profound. And it is also pointless, he thought moodily. Even if the fears are correct, the sheer size of the fleets these bugs commit will make a mockery of our efforts. We cannot fortify every system sufficiently to stop them, and so all our efforts will do nothing but divert desperately needed strength into public relations activities, which ultimately accomplish nothing. Mariah was not alone in his feelings. Both the human Antonov and First Fang Inathar had protested the new directives, but in vain. The political leaders, Zirlukuvalkanai and human alike, refused to heed them, and even in the Khanate, warriors had no choice but to obey orders. And in this particular case, Mariah conceded unhappily, those directives actually made sense, for the warp point SF-80 was about to explore was in a terrifying location. It lay in the Refrak system, a sector capital with a population even greater than Cleon's had been. The small claw's lips wrinkled with disgust as he considered the long-dead commander of the original Refrak survey. Type 11 warp points were elusive, but the instruments of the time had been quite capable of locating them. It would have required a considerable investment in time, however, and Claw Farnas had been in a hurry. He had skimped on the survey. A cursory reading of his log made that plain, and this was the result. An open, unsurveyed warp point at the heart of one of the Khanate's oldest, wealthiest, and most heavily populated sectors. Well, at least Refrak, unlike Cleon, had been fortified for over 3 Orion centuries. Once the initial panic passed, 36 powerful OWPs had been towed to cover the newly discovered warp point, and the Khan had assembled over 100 warships to support them. Quite an escort for one lowly survey flotilla, Mariah thought, then tensed as Harkon began to move towards the invisible hole in space. Soon enough they would know if all this military might was no more than the wasted effort Mariah devoutly prayed it was. The transit surge passed, and Mariah's ships vanished into cloak. After Shanak and Cleon, the Alliance had no choice but to assume the bugs maintained pickets in every explored system, however useless. Henceforth, every survey force would operate only in cloak, which made sense but was expensive in both equipment wear and time. A cloaked vessel could not use active sensors, which cut its sensor reach by 70%, with a consequent increase in the time required to cover a given volume. Using larger survey forces could offset some of that, yet every ship added to a flotilla also increased the odds that it would be detected, despite its ECM. And of course, a bug picket in precisely the right place might pick them up on transit, before they could bring their cloaking systems up, setting all their efforts at stealth at naught. But in this case, Mariah decided, it was unlikely any picket was present. Their entry warp point was a Type 1, 5 light hours from the G8 component of a binary system. Component B was a dimmer K8, almost 6 light hours from Component A and 500 light minutes from Harkon as the light cruiser emerged from warp. But the important point was that Component A had a planet at 6 light minutes, well within its liquid water zone. It also boasted a large asteroid belt at 21 light minutes, with all the industrial advantages that offered. Yet there were no artificial emissions, and the bugs would surely have developed such prime real estate, had they known of it. No one, least of all Mariah Shirino, was going to assume anything, not with the bleeding wound of Cleon so fresh. Yet he felt an undeniable easing of the tension about him as his officers worked their way to the same conclusion. "All units ECM is up, Small Claw," Chiral reported, and Mariah flicked his ears in approval.
"Well executed, son of the Khan. Transmit my thanks to all units. Discreetly, of course."
"Certainly, sir."
"And while you are about it, set up our initial spiral," Mariah added. "We will proceed cautiously, but the sooner we begin, the sooner we can move on to still more emptiness."
Survey Flotilla 80 prowled stealthily about Component A. The warp points of a binary system were invariably associated with the more massive star, moving in their own fixed relationship with it. The math which described the phenomenon always made Mariah's head ache, but he was grateful for the way it reduced his survey area. By his most conservative estimate, however, the task would still consume at least 2 months, and more probably 3, and he bent his attention on ways to keep his personnel alert as they settled in for the duration. What had happened to Cleon made that easier, but nothing could fully offset the sheer, mind-numbing tedium of their task. No one who had ever participated in a first survey could truly appreciate the sheer immensity of any star system, and warp points were elusive prey. Days passed, then weeks, and the cloaked ships continued their methodical activity, winnowing space for the tiny gravitational eddies which might indicate yet another warp point. Mariah was sound asleep when the alarm wrenched him from dreams of his wife and cubs. He lurched upright on his sleeping mat, stabbing for the comm button even before his eyes opened, and light flared in his darkened cabin as his terminal came online. "Bridge," a taut voice said, then changed as the officer of the watch recognized the small claw.
"Char Khan has just reported detection of what may be an unknown starship, sir."
"May?"
Mariah repeated sharply.
"Yes, small claw. If it is, it too is cloaked."
An icy fist squeezed Mariah's stomach, and he made himself pause. It would do neither his image nor the crew's nerve any service to appear flustered, so he kept his voice level.
"Location?" 31 light minutes from Harkon at 063-251, sir."
"Do we have a vector?"
"No, small claw. It appears to be stationary."
"Either that or the Dersh Naku saw Charkon and went dead," Mariah thought grimly. "If he truly exists at all, he is pretending to be a hole in space and waiting for us to make a move."
"Is Son of the Khan Shiral there?"
"I have just arrived, small claw,"
Shiral's voice said, and Harkon's captain's face replaced that of the duty officer.
"The flotilla has implemented standing orders, sir."
"Good, I am on my way. Do nothing but observe until I arrive."
Mariah's mind raced as he killed the comm, scrambled from his mat, and reached for his harness. Charkon might have detected only a sensor ghost, but he dared not assume anything of the sort. Yet how should he proceed? His standing orders had brought the entire flotilla to a halt, which reduced its drive signatures to a bare minimum and made its cloaking systems far more effective. But ships which did not move could not close to obtain better data. The one thing he absolutely could not do was send word back to Refrak. Courier drones could not cloak, and a drone's vector would give the bugs, if there were any bugs, a bearing on the flotilla's entry warp point. No, he must somehow determine whether or not the enemy was present first. Then, if he had the firepower, he must destroy any pickets before their drones reported his presence. If he could not destroy them, he must somehow break contact with at least one of his ships and send it back to Refrak with word of the danger. Whatever he did, the next few days would not be pleasant.
"There it is again, sir,"
Observer First Cheralk said. Mariah raised a hand, stopping the flotilla's senior engineer in mid-report, and watched Cheralk lean forward. The observer babied his passive sensors and computers as he worked the elusive contact, and then his ears flattened in disgust.
"Cheralk!"
He looked up, expression apologizing for the oath, but Mariah waved it off. The last 6 days had been even less pleasant than anticipated. The unknowns, and there was no longer any doubt someone else was in the system, were fiendishly elusive, and Cheralk was his best sensor officer, and more than entitled to an occasional curse.
"Did you get any more on him?"
"Not much, small claw," Cheralk said apologetically.
"Anything at all will be welcome," Mariah assured him.
"Observe your plot, please, sir,"
Cheralk requested, and a crimson icon appeared on the small claw's repeater display. The observer replayed his entire brief track on it, and Mariah watched it slide across the very edge of the sensor envelope and then vanish once more.
His instrumentation must be at least as good as our own, Cheralk said. He knew we were here, not our precise location, but our general position, and came in for a closer look, then broke back out before we got a good look. I think it was Unknown Three this time, sir, but it could have been one we have not seen before.
Mariah flicked his ears and keyed a replay command. The icon slid across the display once more, and there was something damnably familiar about it. Its maneuver was not one a ship of the Zirluku Valkanai would have employed, yet he had the maddening sense that he had seen it, or one like it, before. He replayed it again and muttered a mental curse of his own. That sharp yet graceful turn was familiar, and Cheralk was right. The Unknown's scanners must be at least as good as Harkon's, probably better, for she had not picked it up until it was well into its sensor run. Any cloaking field leaked a little energy, and the emission patterns which oozed through it were distinctive, and so far Survey Flotilla 80 had made tentative IDs on at least 5 Unknowns. Their antics demonstrated that they knew Mariah's command was present, yet they had launched no attacks, and every battle report Mariah had seen suggested the bugs should have attacked by now, if only to draw his fire. Such a maneuver would almost certainly result in the destruction of the attacking unit, yet it would absolutely confirm the presence of his own units and give hard locations on the ships which fired. Given the enemy's willingness to sacrifice starships, Mariah had anticipated just such an attempt for days now. Yet it had not happened, and there was that nagging sense he had seen such a maneuver before. But where? Try as he might, he could not recall, and it was driving him mad. He leaned back in his chair and folded his hands across his belly, tapping his claws together while he thought. There was a limit to how long he could let this game of hunt the Marhang continue. Whether the bugs knew it or not, he knew they posed a deadly threat to Refrak, and his overriding responsibility was to alert the sector capital. He thought a moment longer, then beckoned Shiral to his side and spoke quietly.
Chirak is correct, Shiral. Whoever this is, his instrumentation is excellent. We are unlikely to pin him down without assistance, and we must warn Refrak. We dare not use a courier drone, so we must use one of our ships.
Risky, small claw, Shiral murmured. It was not a protest, simply a consideration of the difficulties, and Mariah flicked his ears in agreement.
Truth, son of the Khan, yet I see no option. We will detach Freikal, Mote, and Sherga. Sherga will be our courier, and the other two will accompany her to the warp point and screen her. She will hold position just clear of the warp point while they run a sweep around it, and she will make transit only when they report the all clear.
With your permission, sir, I will add Jusak and Timkar, Shiral replied.
Daughter of the Khan Diara is the next best observer after Chiralk himself, and I trust her judgment.
An excellent thought, Mariah agreed, and...
Communication laser!
Both officers whirled to the comm officer in shock. The young cub of the Khan raised a hand, cupping his earbud as if to somehow hear better, then looked up in total disbelief.
Someone is lasing us, Small Claw. It, sir, it appears to be a standard Alliance comm protocol.
An Alliance protocol? Mariah looked at Shiral, and the son of the Khan gave an earflick of helplessness. Was it possible the bugs had somehow cracked a captured Allied database when the Alliance had persistently failed to crack theirs?
Put it on intercom, he ordered,
and a voice rattled the speakers. Mariah read standard English, but his understanding of the spoken language was poor, and he looked at Shiral for a translation.
He says, Unknown vessel, this is the Terran vessel Ma-Shana. Identify yourself or be fired upon.
Ma-Shana, Mariah repeated.
What sort of ship name is that?
Sir, I have her on our shipping list,
Shiral's tactical officer reported.
According to the file, she is one of their Hun-class survey cruisers.
Hun-class, is it? Mariah wished, not for the first time, that all TFN ships could have such easily pronounced names rather than the clumsy sounds humans kept inflicting on the poor things. But the thought was only a flicker on the surface of his mind, for the Huns were survey ships, like his own Harkan. Was it truly possible?
Sir, the challenge is repeating,
the comm officer said nervously, and the assistant tactical officer spoke almost in the same breath.
Captain, I am picking up fire control emissions from at least 5 sources.
Very well, Mariah said, far more calmly than he felt.
Come, reply. This is the Sirluku Valkanai cruiser, Harkon.
The cub of the Khan acknowledged, and Mariah looked at the TAC officer.
If this is a ruse, he will fire the instant he receives our reply. Be ready.
Aye, Small Claw.
A moment of intolerable tension hovered, and then the voice came from the speakers again. It spoke much more slowly this time. Slowly enough, even Mariah could follow it.
Harkon, this is Captain Josefa Vargas, TFN, commanding Survey Flotilla 251. You've had us worried, it said.
Chapter 31. Hell's Gate. Small Claw Mariah watched his plot's icons and tried, unsuccessfully, not to feel envious. His Lastin-class cruisers represented the best compromise the Khanate could afford, well-equipped to avoid detection, yet extremely austere, without even command data link. The Khan simply could not divert sufficient funding to build the numbers of survey ships it required if it opted for any more sophisticated design, but the Terran Federation could. And had. Mariah was senior to Captain Vargas, the human survey force commander, yet his ships, for all their numbers, made a poor showing beside her command. TFNS Belisarius, her flagship, was one of the new Garrier B command battlecruisers, with the control systems to provide a data net for her entire flotilla, and her actual survey ships were all Hun Bs, refitted with military engines. It reduced their strategic speed, but gave them the tactical fleetness to outrun any bugs they happened across. Just as Belisarius's data link gave them an excellent chance of outfighting any picket cruisers which crossed their path. And what Mariah envied most of all, perhaps, was TFNS Caravan, an armed freighter built on a converted Dunkirk-class battlecruiser hull and equipped with cloaking ECM as well as a light missile battery. Caravan's cargo capacity was the final support element which allowed the TFN to mount long-ranged, sustained survey operations, which the Khan simply could not match. And the crowning element in Mariah's ignoble envy were the 80 brand-new second-generation recon drones in Caravan's capacious holds. The humans had finally gotten warp-capable drones into production— and the all-but-invisible robots let Vargas probe warp points at greatly reduced risk of detection, and without exposing her own ships to hostile action. It was, he thought, a lesson in the advantages of affluence, and not even the fact that the humans were shipping thousands of the new RD-2s to the Khanate completely eased its sting. Yet for all that, Vargas had reached the system Mariah had named Zaya Faran, in honor of his maternal grandam, only after his own flotilla. Zaya Faran lay at the extreme end of a frontier warp line Vargas had been engaged in extending, and so was of far less value to the Federation than to the Khanate. No doubt the humans would have ceded it to their allies for that reason alone, but under the Treaty of Matar, a system belonged to whoever reached it first— and Vargas had readily acknowledged the Sirluku Valkanai's prior claim on Zaya Faran. Still, they were allies, and they were here, and he and Vargas had decided to operate in concert. Once they had realized they were playing catch-as-catch-can with allies rather than enemies, or rather, once Vargas, with her superior instrumentation, realized it, the small claw reminded himself sourly. They had not taken long to complete their sweep of the system. They had found no sign of enemy vessels, but they had detected two additional warp points, and they would soon make the first move to explore them. In the meantime, Refrak had been brought up to date. Vargas's relief at having a powerful fleet in support distance had been unmistakable, but the human Least Claw had also realized why Mariah was so nervous. She had no more desire than he to show the bugs the way to Refrak, and it was she who had suggested that the fleet element remain in the sector capital rather than advance to Zayafaran. Under the circumstances, it was more important to keep the Refrak connection secret than to protect the survey ships. In the event that the enemy was encountered and managed to track them, the humans had agreed that their combined force would fall back on human space, leading the bugs away from Refrak. Given that no inhabited human system lay within 12 transits, the Federation had far more depth to play with. As to who held title to any additional systems they jointly discovered, that would be up to the diplomats, although Mariah suspected the Khanate's possession of Zayafaran would give it the inside track.
"Captain Vargas reports that she is prepared to deploy the first drone flight, sir,"
Chiral reported, and Mariah flicked an ear in acknowledgement.
"Instruct her to proceed," he said.
"All right, Mal," Josefa Vargas said. "We've got an audience of tabbies just waiting to see how well our new toy works. Let's not embarrass ourselves."
"I think that can be arranged, sir," Commander Malcolm Klesko replied. "But please remember, these things are still on the temperamental side."
"I'll be totally sympathetic," she assured him, "right after I skin you out and salt down the hide."
"You're so understanding," Klesko sighed, but he grinned as he spoke. The RD-2 was his baby, for he'd been assistant project officer on the team which finally got it into production. That was why Vargas had specifically requested him, and getting her request granted was a major coup for her. Yet they both knew he was right. The new drones were, or would be, once they got the kinks out of them, an enormous boon to Survey Command, but they were still a new system, and the conditions under which they had to operate were harsh. Although larger than courier drones, they were smaller than anything else which had ever been capable of making even a single transit, and single transits were useful for survey missions. They had to get through the warp point, look around, and come back. So far, about 1 in 3 was getting home, but only 1 survivor in 10 brought back any useful data. The internal systems of the other 9 were hopelessly addled by the brutal stress of a first transit through an uncharted warp point. R&D promised the failure rate would drop, but the most optimistic success rate projected, even for the fully matured technology, was no more than 40 to 50%.
"Just do your best," Vargas said,
and Klesko nodded before he keyed his boom mic.
"Final systems check," he said crisply.
"All green, sir,"
Ensign Michelson replied instantly.
"Very well, activate the first flight."
"Activating now," Michelson confirmed, and Klesko watched his display. The RD-2s were too large to launch from exo-racks. Instead, they had to be deployed from a cargo hold, pre-flighted in space by vac-suited technicians, and then sent on their way. It was all very complicated, but Klesko felt a glow of satisfaction as the first 10 drones brought their drives online, headed for the warp point in a chain of glittering icons, and one by one vanished.
"Telemetry lost," Michelson reported, exactly on the tick, and Klesko nodded and tipped his chair back to keep an eye on the time. All they could do now was wait.
"Those are very difficult sensor targets, Small Claw," Observer First Charalk said in tones of deep respect.
"Good," Mariah grunted. "Perhaps the enemy will find them equally difficult to detect," he added,
and other officers flicked their ears in sober agreement.
"I wonder if Captain Vargas would sell us a few," Harkon's TAC officer mused.
"I shall ask her," Mariah assured him with a purring chuckle. "Of course, we would also have to rent caravan to haul them around for us."
"I have nothing else to spend my exorbitant salary on, sir,"
the TAC officer replied, and a wave of laughter rippled around the bridge. Malcolm Klesko checked the time, again, and nodded. Assuming the warp point didn't lead to a black hole or something equally drastic, He should see something just about now.
Transit beacon, Ensign Michelson sang out, and Klesko grinned. I've got another one. No, wait. Correction, sir. I have a total of 4 beacons.
Outstanding, Klesko replied.
A 40% return rate was the highest they'd managed yet, but he reminded himself not to start celebrating too soon. The mere fact that his babies had returned didn't mean they'd come home coherent, and he began inputting commands. The first drone was a disappointment. His techs might be able to overhaul the systems for reuse, but the memory core was a complete write-off, and he moved on to number 2.
Aha! That was better. The second stage astro data was shot, which meant the drone could provide no information on whatever lay beyond the warp point, but first stage memory was intact. That gave him a readout on the grav stresses, and even if the other 2 drones contained no data at all, he'd be able to program the second flight for a much gentler transit, which would enhance the chance of obtaining recoverable data by at least a factor of 10. He tapped a key, downloading the grav data to plotting, and let the astrogation techs play with it while he moved on. Drone 3 was a complete write-off. He doubted there was even much point in trying to salvage components, but he handed it off to Michelson's crew anyway. They might get some use out of it, and the things were expensive enough to make the effort worthwhile. Despite the blank on number 3, Klesko felt decidedly cheerful as he turned to number 4. The grav readout alone justified all the hard work R&D had put in on the system, and his thoughts broke off as the drone's memory downloaded to his display. He stared at it for a moment, trying to convince himself he was really seeing it, then looked over his shoulder.
Captain, he said very, very quietly, I think you'd better look at this.
The tension hit Small Claw Mariah and Son of the Khan Shiral like a fist as Josefa Vargas's exec led them into TFNS Balisarius's briefing room. Neither was particularly skilled at reading human expressions, but their host's taut, unnatural stillness required little skill.
Thank you for coming, Small Claw, Vargas said quietly, rising to greet the visitors.
No thanks are necessary, Captain, Mariah replied, after Shiral had translated. Your vessel's data systems are far better suited to processing and displaying this information.
Vargas dipped her head in a small bow and waved the 2 Orions to chairs. She waited until they were seated, then nodded to Klesko. The commander cleared his throat. He was more accustomed to dealing with machinery than tabbies, and he was very much the man on the spot, and brought the holo unit up. A small-scale display of the system beyond the warp point appeared, and he picked up his light pencil and spoke slowly, allowing Shiral time to translate for the Small Claw.
"As you can see, gentlemen, we don't have much detail," he began. "The drone sensors are the best we can build into such a small package, but they aren't very powerful compared to a full-sized starship's. Nonetheless, I think the imagery speaks for itself."
He used the light pencil to pick out the icon of the drone's entry warp point.
"This is a Type 14 closed point. That's the good news. This,"
the light pencil moved to the 2 innermost orbital shells of the G3 primary,
"is the bad news."
The human, Mariah thought, had a distinct talent for understatement. The planets lay at 6 and 10 light minutes respectively, well within the liquid water zone, and they were a solid glare of high-level emissions. Worse, the closed warp point lay little more than a light hour out, well below the system ecliptic. That had given the drone an excellent look up at its environs, and the space between the star's asteroid belt and those planets was heavy with drive fields. Bug drive fields. The Small Claw shivered. Undoubtedly, most of those drive fields belonged to freighters and resource ships, but there were over 200. Gods alone knew how many the drone had not seen, and for the first time, Mariah realized emotionally, not just intellectually, how massively the enemy exploited star systems. That many ships suggested an industrial base at least 5 times as great as that of any Orion system he had ever seen, and it lay 2 transits from Refrak.
Fathers of Shirino, he thought numbly.
the very thing every Allied strategist dreams of finding, a closed warp point in the very heart of an enemy core system. And it lies here.
"It's an El Dorado, gentlemen," Klesko said, "and I wish to God it was anywhere else."
"Truth, Commander," Mariah said softly.
"Smallclaw, this system belongs to the Khanate," Josefa Vargas said. "Whatever the Joint Chiefs ultimately decide, the immediate decision must be yours. Shall I send the second flight drones through or suspend operations pending the decision of higher authority?"
Mariah gazed at the hollow, at the priceless axis of attack which was also the very gate of hell for Refrak, and knew the human captain was right. The decision was his.
"How confident are you that your drones have not been detected?" he asked.
"Mal," Vargas said.
"I'm totally confident that no one actually observed their transit, Smallclaw," Klesko replied. "This drone system came through in remarkably good shape. If anything had been close enough to spot such a small signature, the drone would have picked it up, even if it was cloaked. But we lost 6 drones somewhere in system. The odds are vanishingly small that we could ever find them once power exhaustion takes their telemetry links offline. The only way I could be sure of finding them would be to trigger their homing beacons, and the bugs can't do that without the access codes. But there is a chance someone could literally stumble over them."
"Not a high one, I should think," Chiral put in.
"There appears to be no traffic near this warp point, not surprisingly, given how close to the primary it lies. One does not find many warp points so close in, and it also lies below the ecliptic. Surely there is only a very small chance any of their ships would come close enough to pick up such low signature objects."
"No doubt you're correct, sir," Klesko agreed, "and that's exactly what we designed the drones to accomplish. But unlikely isn't impossible. There is a chance, however slight."
"And if we insert additional drones, we increase that chance," Mariah observed.
"True," Vargas sighed. She leaned back in her chair, one hand toying with a lock of short brown hair, and let her worried eyes sweep her own officers, then looked directly at Mariah.
"Smallclaw, there's going to be tremendous pressure to use this warp point as soon as possible, especially from my people," she said flatly. "We've been totally on the defensive from day one, and so far we've taken far more damage than we've inflicted. No doubt some of your own fangs will feel the same way, but you and I both know what a double-edged sword this is." Mariah was unfamiliar with the metaphor, but he grasped the implications instantly when Chiral translated, and he gave a vigorous human-style nod.
"Is your navy in a position to guarantee Refrak security if this operation goes sour?" she asked bluntly.
"No," Mariah's reply was equally blunt. He disliked admitting that, but it was only truth, and the stakes were too great for anything less.
"Neither can we," Vargas said. "We're a long way from the closest Terran naval base, and our covering force is no more than a heavy task group." She looked around once more, then nodded sharply. "Under the circumstances, I recommend against deploying the second flight."
"I concur, sir," Chiral said,
and Mariah flicked his ears in agreement, profoundly relieved by the human's attitude.
"I think that wise," he said after a moment. "We can always send more probes through later, and I would feel much better with powerful support forces in position first."
"As would I," Vargas looked back at the hollow and sighed. "I've been looking for exactly this since the war started. Now I've got it, and I wish to hell I didn't, or that it was somewhere out back of beyond. But at least this time we found it instead of them finding us, Smallclaw."
"Truth," Mariah said again, and bared just the tips of his fangs.
"It is nice to be on the finding end for a change, is it not?"
"As long as it doesn't turn around and eat us after all, Smallfang," Vargas said very quietly, eyes still on the hollow. "As long as it doesn't turn around and eat us."
Chapter 32 Questions of Command.
Katharat Zartan gazed at his Vilkshatha brother,
and shook his head slowly in what he'd learned was a gesture reflecting sorrowful contemplation of the depths of human evil.
"I fear you have let it go to your head, as you humans say, Ivan Zartan."
Ivan Antonov grinned at him. Kathara's pronunciation of his first name certainly came closer than the